One of the things that really struck me that was interesting about what both of you you said was a concept that's been around for a long time of defamiliarization. And I wondered if you'd both like to kind of comment in more elaborately on that, because I thought that was a really interesting idea, the familiar being rediscovered through the defamiliarizing process of poetic language, vis-a-vis the discovery of the perhaps unfamiliar in the psyche as well. Would you like to comment on that?
Do you want to say something about this?
I think that's partly, yes, that is what I was getting at in terms of one of the similarities between psychoanalytic endeavour and the writing of poetry. And that in some ways, I think some of the importance of the imaginative build-up of both fantasy and awareness of outside reality in some kind of combination that's changing with kind of more reality making way to more fantasy, and until some kind of process happens in which something that feels quite new seems to come, and some awareness which may be stumbled upon. And that, you know, I think that I do think, you know, it characterizes some of the best of those moments in a psychoanalytic work. You know, when one's off the treadmill in a way of going over things in a somewhat predictable way and discovering something new.
Yeah, well, I mean, just to say two perfectly sort of straightforward things about this, I certainly think as a writer that, and I know that I'm not alone. In fact, I think that I'm absolutely typical in this respect. But as a writer, I'm always trying to put myself in that state of mind that we're habitually in on the first 2 days of holiday in a place that we haven't been to before, of seeing things that are completely sort of routine, as though they're fresh from Mars. I mean, that is precisely the state of mind that we're trying to cultivate as writers. It, just in the same way that it wears off during holidays, and by the end of a fortnight in a place you haven't been before, you're kind of, oh yeah, about it all. So in life are you like that as a writer, and it requires quite a sort of effort, almost a moral effort, to keep it fresh and strange. And it's certainly true that I think, as I was indicating, that looking at the business of writing from a slightly different point of view, that insofar as I feel I have any job to do as a writer, and I'm not entirely sure that I do feel I have a job to do quite as a writer. As a citizen, I do. And as an advocate for poems and poetry, I have a job to do. But to use that word in a looser sense, the job that I feel that I have to do as a writer is very closely linked to that, is to make people, as I was saying, reappraise, re-encounter the things which were in their lives all along, though they'd got either blasé about them or simply stopped paying attention to them. So the sense of learning something that we can have when we read a poem, as again I think I was trying to say a minute ago, probably depends less on the sense that it's a thought that we've never had before than it has to do with entering what is essentially a familiar thought from a new angle or at a deeper level.
Angela Joyce, it was just this area I was also interested in commenting on, thinking about, because in fact I think that there's an amazing amount of overlap between what you're talking about together as an analyst and as poet. I'm a psychoanalyst. In my understanding of the analytic process, what we're primarily doing actually is what Andrew has just described, revisiting what is already known. It's rendered unconscious, but nevertheless it's already known. But in some areas of analyses, one can get into a sort of state of mind both in the patient and in the analyst, and I'm curious about whether this happens in poetry as well, where something that that really does feel completely new, something which is completely inchoate, comes to be known about for the first time. And I mean, that doesn't happen very often, actually. That doesn't happen very often. And I'm just wondering whether in the process of writing poetry, whether you ever feel you're in that area, that you're discovering something about yourself, actually, that really is new to you.
It's a very good question. Yes, is the answer, but rarely, as you guess yourself. Can I talk about my experience as a reader before I come to that, what you more directly address, which is to do with writing? As I've already said, my parents were... My mum read a bit, but only a bit, and mainly Iris Murdoch. My dad didn't read. He heroically claimed to have read half a book in his life, which was The Lonely Skier by Hammond Innes. It turned out to be not nearly as exciting as somebody told him it was, and he gave up on it. So I got to reading very late, or comparatively late, and it probably wouldn't have happened at all but for the good offices of a wonderful English teacher who I encountered, or he encountered me, when I was beginning my A-levels, and I've written a little bit about him in the Blood, and I owe him my life, really. But he used to give us he didn't use this phrase for it, but he was a sort of old-style practical criticism person. That's how he'd been brought up. I'm sure he was aware of what tradition that he was a part of, but I wasn't at that stage. So we looked at poems almost without any knowledge of who it was that wrote it. In fact, he quite often used to give us poems that didn't even have the name of the poet at the bottom of the page. So no historicism, none of this. And one day he gave us a poem to read, which actually I quite quickly found out was a poem, in fact, I'm not even sure I hadn't read it already by this stage, by Sylvia Plath, called Mushrooms, that some of you may be aware of. A brilliant poem about mushrooms, the most mushroomy poem about mushrooms I've ever read, in fact. And that's an achievement in and of itself, of course. So I was entranced, and I'm sure everybody else in the room was too, by the brilliant sort of mushroom smell of this poem. But at the end of the lesson, or with 5 minutes left to go, Mr. Way, for it was he, said kind of anything else, in a way which allowed us to feel, or allowed me to feel anyway, that the poem could be kind of rotated in my mind as though it might have a kind of secret subject. And I suddenly thought, oh, Christ, it's about the Holocaust. I mean, sort of like that. I don't think we used the word Holocaust so easily then as we do now, but it was about that subject. And that was a real moment of revelation for me. It was probably the moment in my formative life when I realised that, and this is rather a sort of giveaway thing to say, because I should have wised up about this long before, but better late than never, I guess, that it made me have a new thought about that poem, which was in fact a whole new and gigantic thought about the very thing that we talked about at the outset, about symbolic language. It was an incredible moment. I mean, it really was. I mean, I just felt the scales fall from my eyes about that poem and about literature in general. And in a sense, I've never stopped feeding off that moment of perception, if that's quite the word for it. And so it is, as when we're writing poems, that we want to allow that sort of those other worlds, those parallel universes, to exist in our writing. The problem is that if we're too canny about it and alert our readers to our own canniness when we're writing like that, it's incredibly off-putting. Or at least I find it incredibly off-putting. I mean, it's related to protesting too much. So the marriage between, the relationship between symbolic language and the language of actualities has to be incredibly carefully patrolled, it seems to me, so that, I mean, really, I would say, so that the actuality has always got the upper hand, so that description is revelation, is always allowed to seem the true thing to say about a poem, so that there's enough density and weight, actuality, in the sort of solid surface of things for that to be sufficiently satisfying. And then if we choose, or have a mind to sort of work our way through its various trapdoors into whatever generalities and symbolic universes might lie underneath. So there are two quite different, I mean, clearly linked, but quite different activities going on there, I think.
When you were talking about your relationship with Larkin, I was struck, maybe I'm attaching too much importance to it, by your saying that you avoided topics that you,
yes,
on which you disagree.
No, you're not right. You're not wrong to attach too much importance to it.
I wondered whether that, in fact, might have been a stimulating influence rather than something to be avoided.
Yes, I think that's probably true. I mean, Larkin was a person who, as you remember, in the early part of his writing life, had been very interested in Yeats and very influenced by Yeats. His first book, not the first book that we read so much, but the first book of all, The North Ship, is an intensely Yeatsian performance. And Larkin was very well aware of that famous Yeats remark about how out of the quarrel with our with others we make rhetoric, and out of the quarrel with ourselves we make poetry. And I think that a lot of, which is a brilliant thing to have said, and true, I think, but I think a lot of what's interesting and best about Larkin's poems, this person who is now rather notoriously grumpy, misogynistic, and thereabouts in his private life, but can seem very transcendent and strange and lifted and lifting in his poems. The reason that opportunity arises in the poems, I think, is precisely to do with the fact that he is quarrelling with himself in his poems, which in turn is why it's so unfair and stupid to blame, to denigrate the poems for the things which we might have quarrels with in his life. If we're able to say that these poems are great because they arise out of a quarrel with himself, because he just didn't, because in some sense he didn't like being Philip Larkin, then we're much more nearly towards the truth of things, I think. And by extension of that point, I think we can say that, that I might be able to say that the things that I found difficult in his politics and thereabouts, while being very fond of him in other respects as well, did mean that our friendship was a deep and, I might say, properly argumentative one, which probably made it more influential over the long run with me than it might have done if I'd simply been acquiescing, or more healthily, more productively influential than if I'd simply been acquiescing with everything that he did and said. I mean, I was in awe of him. I was young, and it was a very big deal for me to meet him and spend time with him, and a super big deal for me to feel that he was my friend. But I had arguments with him.
You made a point about the sort of vivid memory of your childhood and how that was a kind of contained, I think you used the analogy of a jam jar, and
yes,
that was as a result of a traumatic experience. And I wanted to ask, is that a kind of phenomenon that you observe in kind of childhood trauma, that they have a very kind of strong memory of their childhood because of something that happened? Is that...
Well, that's also a very interesting question, and I'm not really the person to answer it. I mean, Dennis is the person to answer that, I think, because he has more experience. But before I let him get a word in edgeways, what I would say is that, and perhaps this is partly what you mean, is that I have yet to meet or read a poet who doesn't depend on their childhood in some absolutely vital, vitalizing way. Mm. To connect this with what we were saying about Larkin, or with Larkin, of whom he was speaking just a second ago, one of the things that I always thought was beyond my comprehension about Larkin was that when he was talking about biography, he always used to say that he skipped the early part when they were children. It's because he hated children, because it was so boring for him. Actually, it's precisely wrong that, I think. It's absolutely, in my view, in childhood that the lifelong important things happen. I sometimes think in my own case, and I mean up to the age of 17 when my mum had her accident, I mean, of course, other important, and in one or two cases, very, very important things have happened to me since then. But I can count them on one hand. Before then, they're in the hundreds, perhaps in the thousands.
I find it more impossible to answer that in some ways, but I think those who work with children find that's very true, that something gets wrapped up in a particular image or incident. Or perhaps, I mean, I'm just thinking, I was trying to think of an example which I couldn't really readily give, but a child that I'm seeing at the moment who, you could say that the material is very much overdetermined in a certain direction about this supposedly bad mother who's doing this and doing that. But there are kind of moments of kind of awareness, for example, where the child will bring me to task about something I'm missing, something I'm forgetting to do in a way, which feel a whole lot more significant. Now, I couldn't say at the moment I know what that's about, but I expect that to kind of evolve in some way.
But it suggests that this child has some sense of what matters, what's important in all this. It's not just stuff happening. I mean, he has a sense of its structure.
And possibly that there's much more of an early memory locked in there.
Yeah, very interesting.
And, yeah.
There is, I mean, this is now getting a bit anecdotal, but what the hell. There are two other things I'd like to say about this. One is that my brother has completely wiped his memory clean. He can't remember anything, which I guess is the sort of equal and opposite reaction to the one that I had. I kept everything. He has buried everything. And the other is a different sort of story, which is, and in that sense, more sort of more merely anecdotal, which is that, as you may already know, or as Dennis certainly knows, in the first chapter of In the Blood, which is when the accident happens, I'm not with my mum when she has the accident because I'm off with my first significant girlfriend going to a party. And what I hoped was going to happen that night didn't happen because of my mum having had her accident. And the next morning when I went home was the last time that I'd seen this woman, girl as she then was, woman as she now is. Anyway, when my book came out, kind of bang on my email, there was an email from her saying, I am that Julia, because I named her in the book. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. we must see each other again. But I didn't want to be the one who sort of suggested that, because it seemed a bit creepy somehow. Anyway, I wrote back saying, goodness me, how fascinating, you know, what are you doing and all this. She then wrote back saying, can we have tea? And I then wrote back saying, no, let's have lunch, because I didn't really want to do this without having drink around. And then she said something absolutely amazing, which was, and I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying this, which was that when she was 26, in other words, 10 years after this night, she had a very bad car accident and has lost her memory up to the age of 26. So she only knows that she knew me because her sister told her. So I'm the man who remembers everything, and she's the woman who remembers nothing. And we did have lunch, and drink was taken. But I felt very peculiar about it, because I could have told her anything, and she would have had to believe me. Isn't life odd?
Can I be greedy and ask two questions, please, just in case you find the first too trivial? Wonderful idea of sealing your life up in the jam jar when the awful event happened. I mean, what would have happened? I mean, how would your development have been, your writing, and obviously impossible question, had the jam jar not been sealed at that point?
Right.
And that's my first question. The second question, sorry to be greedy.
No.
I mean, too obvious, really, but analysis, child analysis, Larkin's wonderful first colourful line,
yes.
Colourful language,
yes.
Which perhaps we should just touch on,
yes, quite
about
right.
The impact that mums and dads have on their children. How much tongue did he have in his cheek when he said that? Is this just one of those quarrels, one of those contradictions? What did he really think?
Well, that's very good. Of course, the first question is not flippant or facetious at all. It's and as you rightly say, I mean, it is completely impossible for me to give you an accurate answer to it. What would accuracy mean in such a context? I think the only thing I can say is that because I'd already started to write poems before my mum had her accident, the chances are that I would have continued to do it. All I can be sure about is that it gave me, and I wish that it hadn't done this, that her accident gave me an absolutely compelling subject when I was starting off, and I wrote about not very much else for a long time when I was beginning to write poems. And I think, so I can say that, and I can also say, which is part of that, that it's welded together in my mind in a way that has never since been separated, the idea that poetry is about serious and sad things. As far as I'm concerned, and I know this isn't generally true, and it shouldn't be generally true, but for me, poetry is the sadness club. And that probably wouldn't have happened without it. I like reading funny poems. I think they have tremendous value. They give a lot of pleasure to a lot of people. But the sad poets and the sad poems are the ones that mean most to me. So it's Christina Rossetti and Hardy and... there is probably more to say about that, but those are the two things that quickly come to mind. Larkin's line about how our mums and dads fuck us up seems to me sort of basically true, but the next line is the really true one, I think. They may not mean to, but they do. I mean, as mums and dads ourselves, on the whole, we try not to and make our mistakes. But whether we like it or not, we do it. And that's how the world continues, for good and for ill, in this sort of loving, abrasive way.
Please, may I ask you if you had an analytic experience, and if so, what effect it's had on you?
Well, I'm very happy to talk about that. I've seen analysts since about the... I first went to an analyst when I was a student at university, and he's dead now, so I can talk about him. His name was Seymour Spencer. He was at the Warnford. I went there mainly, as far as I was aware, because of what had happened to my mum, and I hadn't got anywhere near sorting it out. And he did something absolutely extraordinary about 6 weeks into my seeing him, which was to fall asleep. And I was very, very poor at the time too, and having to pay large amounts of money for this, and I just thought, good God. I'm going to have to get myself better. If the best I can do, the most interesting thing I can... And he didn't just sort of nod off, he sort of pulled up the duvet. So that wasn't a great start, really. Though he was, I think, quite a distinguished person. Perhaps he was past his best by the time he got to me. Or perhaps I was just very boring and he'd heard it all before. Anyway, so I saw him, and then periodically over the years I've seen people, and I'm seeing somebody now whom I don't see very regularly but value very, very highly, who's great, really a great guy. And it means a lot to me to see him. And that's probably all I could and should say about it, actually. But I did want to mention it, partly, of course, because it's the answer to your question, but also because all this stuff that we started out by saying about the various similarities, echoes, resemblances, correspondences between the sort of activities that I guess a lot of us undertake, whether we're writers or analysts, are actually sort of rehearsed, visited in a way when I talk to this fellow.
Just while we're finding another question, I'd like to ask something of you both about, because it's uppermost in my mind, Andrew, because I've just finished reading it quite recently. It struck me that In the Blood had a lot of novelistic technique in it, I say that admiringly rather than any other way. The idea that the past is a fiction, I thought was And I'm not saying you weren't true to the facts, but I thought that the novelistic kind of imposition upon the material, and I wondered if
that's completely fair.
We could relate that somehow to the reconstruction of the past in psychoanalysis as well, as a kind of potential for fiction, either in its ordering or invention in some way. I don't know.
No, it's a good question, that.
Well, I think what I was getting at when I was talking about large brush theories was about that kind of those kind of broad hypotheses of how things link together, which are probably quite elaborate fictions, which are then undone by further kind of experience. And it, in a sense, it is true that fiction is truer than fact, so much that passes for fact has little kind of sustainable life over time in analysis, and there's something else explored and brought out. Perhaps that's as much as I've got to say on that.
Well, of course, I think that's true too, though I but I do, as you do, have a respect for fact as such. Never trust the teller, trust the tale. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. I mean, we're surrounded by other people's good opinions and valuable opinions about how distortions of actuality can tell us the profounder truth. And that's certainly something I subscribe to. It's part of why one writes, after all, why one writes imaginatively, rather than going to be a historian or whatever else you might be. I mean, they write imaginatively in their way too, but you see what sort of distinction I'm trying to make there. Or journalists, say, who has a responsibility to tell the deliver the facts as they see it. It is perfectly true that one of the manifest deceptions, if I can put it like that, about In the Blood, and it's going to be true too of its sequel that I'm about a third of the way through at the moment, which is a book about my father, is that it appears to be artless, ingenue, utterly sort of as utterly in the moment as I could make it. But of course, it is highly manufactured. Right. For anybody who can be bothered to do it, it's divided into chapters, and there are sort of prevailing images within the chapters that hold them together. I hope that people reading it just sort of quickly and in the ordinary way of general readers wouldn't notice such things. But if anybody is interested in rootling around and seeing how they're shaped, I mean, that is all there. So it is very manufactured. And I don't feel in the least bit weird or awkward about saying that, because that is how I think art works, and I didn't want just to convulse. It's not a convulsion, it is a piece of writing. And it's something that I'm very interested in the other writers that I like most. I mean, just to take Edward Thomas, for instance, who is my the poet that I most deeply love. Edward Thomas is somebody who appears to write poems which are just sort of spaghetti thoughts pulled out of its head. I mean, they're rhymed and so on, so sure, we can see at a glance that there is some artifice going on here, but they do seem absolutely sort of instantaneous, natural, unforced, and because we happen to know that he wrote them all very quickly and in a very short space of time, that sense of their spontaneity is rather ramified by that. Actually, I think when we start to look at them, particularly those of us who have our heads full of romantic literature, we can see that they are, as William Hazlitt would have said, they're sort of centos, really. I mean, they're little echo chambers of reference, allusion, which are so skillfully handled that they never disturb the naturalness of the delivery, but that's what they are. I mean, they are highly organized works of art, and I have to say, every interest in aiming for the same kind of thing, if only I could, but that is the sort of ideal that I have in mind.
Hi. I spent most of my life learning songs and having to interpret them, okay? And it's quite interesting, some of the things that you said. The last poem that you read about your mother and the horse, how long ago did you write it? Were you very young?
No, I wasn't very young. I wrote it about 10 years ago.
And when you actually wrote it then, the feeling you had when you actually wrote it, and now that you read it now, and you've probably read it quite a few times, does your feeling actually change throughout when you actually first wrote it, or does it go back to the feeling that you had when you wrote it, if you know what I mean?
No, I do see exactly what you mean. Well, I'm sure you do have a similar sort of feeling to this, but, and you mustn't think that I'm claiming things for myself as I say this, but all of us who write things, all of us who do any sort of work, know that we have good days at work and bad days. And we know that when we write poems or write songs that work better than on the days when we write less good, etc., songs or poems. And I knew when I wrote that poem that it was one that had worked, basically. I'd wanted to write it for a very long time. When she was a tiny little girl, my daughter, in the wonderful way of children, when we'd been talking about my mother, had said, "What happened to the horse?" And I just thought that was such a brilliant sort of sideswiping thing to say about this subject. I mean, that is something that children are so genius at. They don't realise that it's not the kind of main route to the subject. They don't know what the main route to the subject is, so they just say these wonderful things. And it suddenly opened it up for me, and I'd been trying to write this poem for years, actually, and I could roughly see what it was. And then I was reading in the Lake District with Seamus Heaney, a poet I profoundly admire, and so say all of us. And we gave this reading together, and then we went to supper, got back to the hotel, I fell asleep, and I woke up with Seamus's poem sort of ringing in my head in that very interesting mixture of admiration and competition that we, if we're being honest, all must admit to, seriously. And I thought, right, I'll do it now, before breakfast. So I did. And I just wrote it out like that, very, very quickly. And I hardly changed anything later on. I suppose it took sort of 10 minutes. It took almost as much time to write as it does to read it. But what had happened was that it was really sort of cooked before then. So I did have strong feelings about it immediately after I wrote it. I wrote it quite upset, but also very sort of intent and thinking, this is it. I know this is going to work. So I was optimistic when I was writing it in a way that I'm not often when I'm writing. Generally when I'm writing, and I hope this isn't your experience, but I dare say it might be, I'm thinking, oh God, you know, the wheels are coming off.
I'm not a poet writer. I learn songs, so I have to interpret what the person.
Well, you know the feeling that I'm describing. I'm sure. And I do sometimes still feel a sort of echo of that original feeling when I'm reading it. And this might be quite a good way to end, since we're talking about public and private in one way or another through the evening. That I also knew when I wrote it what I could bring myself to say in public when I stood up to read it, supposing it did work and I was going to stand up and read it. And that is generally true, and this perhaps is the right an appropriate thing to say at the end of things, that we make these sort of calculations about what we can get away with, what we can bear to say, what we can bear to let on about when we're writing. Graham Greene talks about the writer having a sliver of ice in their heart. Actually, it's an iceberg. We can always bring ourselves to say more than we think, more than other people think we might be prepared to. It's part of being a writer, I think, that. Alas, for the people who live with us.
Thank you. Sorry. Well, I've got to wind things up now. And I wanted to thank you all for coming along and being such a brilliant audience and asking such perceptive questions of you. That's generated a lot of interesting discussion, and I want to thank you above all for that. I've got a few more sort of thank yous to say. I'd like to thank Ruth Robinson for her organisation of not just this event, but for all this series of events, and the amount of energy and time she puts into that benefits us all. And I'd like to thank Caroline for wandering around with the mic, which is really brilliant. And Richard for our sound engineer, because I know that I will want to listen to this discussion again and hear all the points that were made, because it's been fascinating but dense, and I think there have been some really kind of taxing and interesting questions come out of it across both strands of our guests' expertise, the literary and the psychoanalytical. So I'd like to end, obviously, with thanking Dennis and Andrew very much for their contribution. It has been a privilege to be here. Another reason I'd want to go and listen to this discussion as soon as I can is that Andrew has a wonderful way of capturing ideas in precise and cogently termed phrases and sentences, which are of the moment, are transient. And I just want to hear some of those again, because they stick in the mind, but not quite the way they were originally formulated. So on that, I'd just like to say thank you to you both very much indeed.